Welcome to the Supply Chain Pioneers Podcast, where we highlight industry leaders on the forefront of innovation and technology in planning, procurement, and logistics. Hosted by your supply chain pro to know, Ulf Venn.
I'm Lukas. I'm an industrial engineer by education and started my career in management consultancy. When I started studying, I was reading this paper of Sheffy and Rice from 2005. And that was the first time that made me realize that this thing with the inbound logistics really makes a difference. Customers were facing the problem that when new machinery and equipment arrived in line with the spare part lists, the question always was, hey, what are these parts really? After 5 years, I started a journey with my co-founder of SpareTech.
Supply Chain Pioneers is powered by Everstream Analytics. Everstream gives you the predictive insights and analytics to make your supply chain faster, smarter, safer, and leaner. Go to everstream.ai to book your demo today.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Supply Chain Pioneers. And today with me, I have Lukas Biedermann, who is the founder and CEO of SpareTech. Hi, Lukas.
Hi.
So, as always, Lukas, we would like to start with a short introduction from your side before we go into depth on your career.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you all, first of all, for having me. It's a pleasure. I'm Lukas. I'm an industrial engineer by education and started my career in management consultancy, mainly in automotive and aerospace industries. And after 5 years, I started the journey with my co-founder of SpareTech. And now we are supporting companies. I mean, we might talk about this in a bit to increase their supply chain resilience for industrial spare parts for their machinery and equipment.
Yes, rest assured, we will talk about all of it in a few minutes, quite in depth. But we start with the start, right? Because I think it's all about you today and your amazing journey throughout supply chain and being a founder and building a company. So at the start of your career, which was while you were studying engineering and going for a PhD, you actually wrote about supply chain management. And what was your inspiration of focusing on supply chain management?
Yeah, well, to be very honest, when I started studying and in the bachelor program, I was leaning more into aerospace, and then in master's degree more into production logistics. I was reading this paper of Sheffy and Rice from 2005, I believe. It's like the supply chain view on the resilient enterprise. And that was the first time that made me realize, okay, this thing with the inbound logistics really makes a difference for, you know, manufacturing companies in terms of, you know, parts availabilities, and they're like in a global competition, it indeed is a competitive differentiator. So that was the moment in time when I realized, okay, this is interesting. I want to dig deeper into that.
Yeah, and you did. And actually, as part of your PhD thesis, you looked at 34 success factors for building a supply chain risk management successfully and making a framework out of that. So we cannot really touch on 34 success factors today, but maybe can you talk about what makes for you the three most important success factors of in your framework and why?
Yeah. I think the good news is that it's, I think, 24, not 34, but still many. So okay. Your question is very, very good. I think when we talk about supply chain resilience, and I think, you know, when I started looking into it, it was 2014. And my first, assessment was why is there a term resilience from the fields of psychology and even the ecology entering the logistics space and supply chain space? This is, sounds like a little bit sort of like BS bingo. And then diving into it, it turned out, okay, that might be really interesting. There's like ideas of the system theory in it and you know, the network effects and so on. When it comes down to the success factors, so resilience is basically based on two things. You know, it's the kind of agility and the robustness. And in In English, it's only the one word, like adaptability. In German, we have two. It's like Angepasstheit und Anpassungsfähigkeit. And I think that describes it pretty well. Like, depending on your business and on the product that you produce, either a very agile supply chain is very suitable, or a very robust, you know, with more, you know, redundant systems in place and so on, to determine how fast you want to, you know, cope with challenges in terms of being robust to endure disruptions versus being super flexible to adjust really quick to new, disruptions that stress the supply chain. So that's, I think, the key to having this to, principles in mind, and then based on that define. So what does it mean for my multiple, you know, in terms of sourcing strategies, like multiple sourcing versus single sourcing? And, you know, what does it mean in terms of IT infrastructure? What does it mean in terms of my organizational structure? What does it mean in terms of my transport modes and so on and so on? So that's where the 24 success factors come into play.
Yeah. Okay. So we heard two things that are very important: adaptability, so in terms of resilience, and agility. But then what are other 24 success factors that are really important?
Out of those, I would say, having an IT infrastructure in place that allows you, that creates transparency and, you know, visibility of information is super key. Mm-hmm. And I remember back in the days at the DHL Innovation Center, that there was this one of the first, I think, tools ever on the market, DHA Resilience 365, was super inspiring, because that was kind of the idea to bring all the 500,000 pairs, pairs of all the, you know, DHL stuff worldwide into one global system to create transparency. So that was really something, I think, that made it very tangible that transparency, visibility of information is key at a starting point, really, to create supply chain resilience.
Mm-hmm. Visibility for you is very foundational to resilience, right? You cannot, absolutely, you can only manage what you can see, essentially. So, yeah. I guess you have been in the DHL Innovation Center while you were at Porsche Consulting, which actually leads me to my next question, because there you have seen a lot of different supply chain setups, right? And as far as I understand Porsche Consulting, it's a lot about automotive and aerospace. So what are, like, commonalities between especially these two very different supply chains, but also where do you see the differences?
Indeed. No, so for everyone not maybe being too familiar with the Porsche Consulting, it's kind of the consulting company, like 100% daughter company of the Porsche car manufacturer, and doing consulting service businesses in various industries, really, worldwide. And that was indeed a very, you know, great opportunity to see many, many factories from the inside across the globe, and to see their supply chain strategies and setups. And in terms of your question, automotive and aerospace, how does it differ? I mean, for sure, you know, in the automotive industry, very advanced, you know, supply chain planning processes and executional, like operational excellence, oftentimes, especially when it comes to supply chain and sourcing strategies, focusing on multiple sourcing. And that is possible because of, you know, a lot of, you know, kind of a huge range of suppliers that can indeed also serve, you know, as suppliers for various OEMs, automotive OEMs, whereas in the aerospace industry, you oftentimes had the situation that it's such a special and, also from a technology point of view, such an unique part that you want to source, that there oftentimes is only one supplier. And then you have a competition of the global OEMs like Boeing, Airbus, Embraer, Bombardier. They all want to source from them. So it's a capacity game, you know, who secures the capacity of the critical supplier. So that was more often the key question, like, and a competitive question as well, you know, and ultimately this leads, you know, when it comes to make or buy, to the situation where you can see that Airbus, Boeing, there's a lot of insourcing activities in the past 5 to 10 years visible, where they simply kind of, you know, increase their vertical integration because they wanted to secure the capacities of critical suppliers. And I think this is a key difference in automotive, where the tendency rather has been to, you know, reduce the level of manufacturing depth and rather, outsource as many of the manufacturing steps to suppliers.
But then outsourcing comes with other risks, right? Resilience is getting less because of outsourcing. So I do think we see more and more people and more companies being, again, interested in insourcing a few of the most fundamental parts.
Yeah.
Like batteries, for instance.
Yeah.
Good. So looking at that, right, still a little bit more, because I think something that is often overlooked is cross-industry exchange. We see that happening on some conferences, but let's be real. I think it's very hard to drive adaptability of these different concepts you see in some of the speeches on like very big conferences directly to your day-to-day life as being from another industry. How do you think cross-industry cross-industry exchange could be worthwhile, and when yes, in which kind of format?
I think it's not a question of if, it's a question of how fast can you get into the game. So I'm personally very convinced, and you know, the future world and my vision of the global manufacturing industry is what I call the zero waste industrial sharing economy. You know, I'm 100% certain that the global manufacturing industry will fundamentally change because, you know, the global megatrends, digitization, supply chain disruptions, you know, the climate crisis and legislation, not only in the European Union, really forces companies to shift gears and to collaborate across company borders. Mm-hmm. And this means that, first of all, sharing of data becomes important, sharing of knowledge, sharing of risks, thereby will be more, you know, will be a little bit easier. And on an operational level, this means that sharing of inventories, for example, is one field within, you know, the supply chain field that, thanks to like stock transparencies, you see that already in the MRO business for aircrafts, right, in aerospace. That's already an existing case, cross company collaboration for MRO parts for the aircrafts. So I think this is a clear trend, and in combination with the need to save resources, you know, and reduce waste, I think that this will also have a big impact on a positive impact on the CO2 footprint for those companies that do collaborate.
Mm-hmm. So you are thinking that supply chains are moving from an ecosystem to an ecosystem?
You could probably say that. I think the idea here is really the famous, you know, it's the idea of more local to local. Mm-hmm. You know, it's when we look at, let's take an example. If you look for like spare parts for machinery and equipment, you know, there's the trend of, 3D printing. So this is kind of democratizing production resources in a way that this printer could be located everywhere, right? So within, let's say, an automotive cluster like Stuttgart, having Porsche, Mercedes, and Bosch and suppliers and all nearby, with a high degree of common parts in the factories, that does not only allow, you know, pooling of industrial spare parts, but also allows, like in terms of flexibility, to have very flexible production capabilities nearby. And I think this is then where, from all angles, cost, resources, time, and a very good efficiency gain for the supply chains to be more local, actually.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I get it. So I want to move on actually to the next topic now, which is spare tech, right? Next part of your journey, we have now talked about your time at Porsche Consulting and seeing various industries. We talked about resilience. And how did all of that culminate into the idea of spare tech? And what is it that spare tech actually does?
Yeah, indeed. So when touring the factories on the various continents, oftentimes, especially in ramp-up projects, customers were facing the problem that when new machinery and equipment arrived in line with the, you know, bill of materials and the spare part lists, the question always was, okay, what are these parts really? Is it an OEM part from the machine manufacturer, or is it, who's the original parts manufacturer? Because that's a very intransparent business because of the high margin for the machine manufacturers linked to their spare parts business. So that was a quest where the best possible solution existing back then was Microsoft Excel, going through the list, removing special characters, doing VLOOKUP with material exports from the inventory to see, do I already have some of the parts in stock or not? And then you were always pressed on time. So someone you had to make the call and say, okay, let's purchase the parts. At the goods receipt, you were opening the box and realizing, oh, this cylinder, this is a Festo cylinder. I just bought it from my machine OEM for a markup of four times the price, and I already have it in stock right over there. Mm-hmm. So that is a very costly, inefficient, and wasteful process. So that was basically, and when we saw that across the industries and so many factories, Martin and I decided, okay, let's do this. This is such a real problem. And it's so important. There's so much opportunity in it. That was basically the idea why we started SpareTech 5 years ago. And what we do today is not only to offer a fully automated BOM check for these industrial spare part lists, but on top of that, offer some features that allow you to search very conveniently and efficiently in your global production network and beyond, in to see live transparency of spare parts at existing suppliers worldwide. It allows you to basically take over original product data when creating new data sets in your system. It has some, you know, kind of master data as a service capabilities where we feed you with discontinuation informations from original manufacturer. So that's kind of the feature set that customers appreciate to make their spare parts management much more efficient and you know, in terms of time, money, and resources.
Okay. So I got a question on that actually, which is, hearing about this, I do believe there was a high interest from the industry actually to keep a lot of these information hidden. So how was the interplay between you coming up with this innovative solution and convincing mm-hmm. these companies to work together with you mm-hmm. to help their customers and by also the risk of eroding their margin quite a bit?
Yeah. It's a very good question. So what we basically took as a starting point is the pain point from the operators, you know, the automotive, the manufacturers that have the pain in digesting the bombs and in purchasing the parts, right? So they want transparency, they want the best possible price and want the parts when they need that. So the problem is within the supply chain. Turns out that the original spare part manufacturer has a very high interest that the end customer has that very right data set in its system because they have strong relationships already and they sell a lot of spare parts to the end customer, but the purchase process is so difficult because oftentimes they really don't know what they mean. So what are you talking about? There's a missing configuration information on the request that you sent to me. You know, it's like, especially in automotive, EDI, you know, 50% of the time doesn't work, and there's manual effort on this, you know, original part manufacturer, to give you one example, to actually process the purchase order. And it's similar to the hotel industry before Airbnb and Booking.com were born. There was a lot of intransparency on the market, and that created the need for innovation. And obviously, the high margins were reduced. Thankfully for all, you know, all of us as being the consumers of hotels. And this is the same thing that happens right now in the manufacturing industry, that in the spare parts industry, that these high margins are under pressure. The intransparency is under pressure, basically regardless of the existence of SpareTech. That's the industry trend. And that means that transparency brings the original part manufacturer and the operator much more connected and much more closer to each other. And everyone in terms of suppliers and machine OEMs, you know, is asked to also, you know, step up their business model to, you know, not only rely on high spare parts margin, but maybe increase, you know, the vertical integration and the service level and the value add to the customers to still be part, you know, an important part in the service and after sales business.
Interesting.
A little bit of a lengthy answer. I apologize.
No, actually, it was a great answer. And I have a follow up. I have a meta question on this again, because I think this is so a good answer because it's in depth and operational, and it just makes a lot of sense once you hear it. But I would now challenge that when you started SpareTech, I cannot imagine that you already knew all of that at the very beginning. I think, how did that storyline develop to be that crisp? Because that doesn't sound like it's done in a day, essentially.
Yeah. No, it's good. I mean, we had this hypothesis that was our look at the market, right?
Okay.
And it turned out that we had one unfair competitive advantage at the very beginning, and that is coming out of Porsche, having, you know, we are 100% independent, which is very important for us. So there's no ties anymore. But having Porsche as a first customer, having Porsche spread the word into the Volkswagen group across the brands was obviously a huge accelerator in the early days. And when we got all the contracts, you know, with their logos on it, so hero logos, we went to Siemens, Festo, Rexroth to say, hey, knock, knock, here's the thing. They want you to provide us your spare parts data, and we can help you to really maneuver all the, you know, obsolescence information into their material master. And obviously they said, oh, that's great, because we have the data at hand, reproduce the product data. And if you make sure you bring it into the systems of our end customers, that's lovely, because we are the distribution supply chain. We don't know exactly where our parts actually ended up, because the machine operator doesn't tell exactly which part is in which machine at which customer. So suddenly we were creating a link, hero logos, hero partners, and that made us scale our platform very, very fast. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the USP today, that only SpareTech has a data reference of industrial spare parts that goes beyond everything that's available in the internet, because the manufacturers also were digging out product information from the past decades out of some legacy systems on their side to make sure we match it in the installed base of the industry to fuel their service business, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, that's kind of our, really our USP, having this database, the intelligent matching algorithms to really understand for every part, you know, there's a lot of complexity in it. When is it sufficient to have an article number? When do you need the right type code in combination? Where do you need a serial number? What's qualifying a configurational part for each supplier and why? So a lot of data challenges lie within that solution. But to your point, yes, we didn't see that at the beginning, how difficult it is. We took the advantage of serving strong customers early on and bringing on the relevant suppliers. And as in every company that starts from scratch, we were lucky, and in our case, working hard and being lucky turned out to be a successful way. But as you say, it's not to be underestimated that there's a lot of unconscious unknowns at the very beginning, and you just have to move fast and learn fast and be lucky, not to underestimate. There's a lot of luck involved to be successful.
Yeah, I want to actually touch on one point that is often underlooked, which is you have a co-founder, right? A partner in crime, essentially.
An amazing partner, yes.
Yeah. And my question is, because we had a similar story recently with Rapid Ratings, where also the founder had a co-founder, and he said that for him, it was extremely important to have a co-founder that he totally was aligned to the hip, because it was a question if he would have even started the business by himself. Mm-hmm. And also the amount of risk taking that was done and the amount of benchmarking and considerations really helped. So how's the interplay between you two, and how did that actually help starting the journey and getting you started?
Yeah. I think it's super crucial. The founder match needs to be 100% there. We know each other already for more than a decade. We even our families, you know, we share common interests, and I think this level of trust just needs to be so deep that within all the highs and lows across the journey, you can always 100% rely on each other, no matter what. And during the journey of building a company, even like, you know, life changes as well. So having a strong co-founder and a partner in crime, as you said, kind of, you know, that's super important also, by all means, you know, for the business challenges, for all mental challenges that come along with that, with the challenges of life. It's just, you know, having another, you know, strong partner on the side. And I think that's, I feel very fortunate to have Martin as my co-founder. And Martin actually had the initial idea, you know. So when he basically came out and said, Lucas, here's the thing. I'm super grateful having such a great journey with him over the past years. Yeah.
And as far as I could count, it's 6 years. And I want to fast forward now a little bit to today. So you're doing this for 6 years. You collected millions of dollars, actually, yeah, very impressively. And SpareTech is now in a very good place. So how has that journey been over time for you? Has it been a little bit of a roller coaster, or has it been the up and up you see in the media?
It's always a roller coaster. And, you know, it's great if the positive, you know, the highs basically equalize the lows. But, you know, it's every entrepreneur, every, I mean, not every, but most of them, they would probably say, yeah, it's for sure, it's a roller coaster. There's not only highs. So in a nutshell, the first 5.5 years, how did it go? The first year we were working hard to get the first version of the product, February 2020, first version is there, boom, right on time with COVID. Very lucky for us, being a software as a service company, now I don't have to travel to one customer a day somewhere in Germany to showcase the software, which was the basically the status quo in the industry to do sales.
Yeah.
They were now forced to use Skype, not existing anymore, but back then was in, you know, 2020, most of our customers used Skype. Suddenly I could have four, like, you know, demo calls a day. So for a young startup, amazing coincidence to reach more customers fast. And that made us profitable after 2 years. And then we sit down and say, what do we do with the company? Being, you know, a dozen of people, do we hire one more with every new customer that we onboard and make this a solid, you know, steady growing business, which is super attractive? Or do we think there's more potential for the business model? And we decided, and we you know, for it was clear, we have seen it on a global scale, the problem. So we shared and always do share the ambition to bring the solution to a global audience. And that's when we decided to go to basically fund, raise external money, and brought in amazing investors, not only great angel investors, but institutional investors. And then, yeah, over the lifetime now, we have raised around 20 million euros, which I think is nothing one should be proud of, because it's money that, you know, is just fueling your growth. But it's not, you do not do this for the sake of raising money, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
What we did with the Series A last year now is that we incorporate our office in the US. So right now we're expanding to the US. And this makes us super excited, because that's a key milestone on our, you know, mission to enable the global manufacturing, you know, spare parts business to become a zero waste industrial sharing economy. So yeah, looking ahead 6 years or 5 years from now, and hopefully we were able to continue that growth path and serve hundreds or maybe even more customers worldwide, and support them on their spare parts management.
Yeah. I'm personally very confident that that will succeed. So
I appreciate your confidence.
Yeah, I do. And I mean, you still have the Swabian, money is here to be spent in order to get more money, and being very conservative in your spending attitude, which probably will help. So that is very good.
Without being a Swabian myself.
Yeah, I know, but you live there.
Just for
right?
the reference. But I appreciate that mindset. Indeed, I think it's a healthy mindset when, you know, starting a business, that you think about where to spend every single euro. Yeah.
Yeah, so you assimilated over time, right? From where you come from, you traveled south and assimilated over time. Yeah. That's very clear. Yeah, no, but it's good. I love that.
Very good.
Good. So thank you so much for sharing the story of SpareTech. I personally find it to be super invigorating, because I feel it's a very interesting startup coming from a clear use case. It's about creating transparency. So really great.
Thank you.
But now I want to talk about more technology in general. So we have now seen your example of how technology can advance a space and really move the needle and change a culture as well and bring great benefits for all sides. But how do you see technology advancing manufacturing companies today? And where are we on that journey from your point of view?
So I think there's many angles maybe to answer the question, but if I take maybe two, you know, the one is, for every product that serves a customer need, technology can help to fuel from the R&D to the actual delivery for all the processes to create new products within a company. I think it's always great to see how innovative companies are out there, no matter if it's just, you know, it's an automotive or an aircraft manufacturer, or even like, you know, companies such as Festo on in industrial machines. Like, there's a lot of technology and innovation happening right now. So I think the human species, as a, you know, very good tool maker, is embracing technology at a large scale in, you know, these days to really increase you know, quality of life, and hopefully we'll also master the challenge of kind of saving the local planet to, you know, have a room to live for future generations. So I think from a very macro perspective, technology is a fantastic opportunity to increase life quality. For sure, there's always the kind of the dark side, you know, technology being misused. I skip this for now. What I think, if we go a little bit, you know, some layers deeper, also from an entrepreneurial perspective, what I personally think, like in a day-to-day business, technology really improved my way of working and way of living, because, you know, when we built this company, we use very modern tech stack on the R&D side, but also like on the sales side. You know, if we think about a modern CRM tool, and when we think about like Notion as a not more than a wiki, basically, you know, Slack, Gong, so many tools that increase and ease daily operations as a young company. I think that's a competitive advantage as well that helps us to move fast as a business. And I think when it comes again to global competition and Europe, Germany being part of that competition, we have, I think, a huge opportunity within existing, but also all the startups that are currently funded to embrace technology to create fundamentally successful companies, also in the way how these companies rely on their tech stack internally, right? So, you know, those are some perspectives on technology that that fascinate me, and yeah, I think it's a great time to live in, like 2024 on planet Earth. I think a lot of fantastic things going on.
Yeah, for sure, definitely better than using using sticks and stones to make fire. That's definitely the case, right? Also a better opportunity to live longer.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so much room to create indeed. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we have a lot of room to innovate right now. I feel that's quite amazing. And also, for example, I mean, I didn't have the chance to go to Stuttgart, but us being able to record the podcast right now is also part of this innovation journey. And
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And also for, I mean, I just remember that before COVID, I always had to stand in line for going to the public swimming pool in Cologne. I had to stand in line forever in order to get a ticket. And now I can buy them online. So we yes. are really developing quality of life right now.
Yeah, true.
Okay. So once you are done with being the founder and CEO of SpareTech, once you're done being the technology philosopher that you are in the evening, and once you are done with dealing with family and so on and so forth, what is a way that you release your pressure that builds up over the whole day? What do you do as a catalyst?
I sleep. At the end of the day, I sleep. No, but I think as a catalyst, there's actually one thing that is super cool for me personally, because I turned into a musician when I was 7 years old. I'm a drummer, and I stopped playing. I teach a little bit during my university time. I stopped playing effectively during, you know, when I started my professional career. And only last year, for Christmas, I finally got myself, I can maybe show it really quick, spontaneously. I got myself an e-drum kit in my office. And it's amazing because I just sit there for 4 minutes. And because of the coordination effort for my brain, it's even more effective than meditation for me personally, because it gets me out of any thought process that was running. So I spent those super short breaks to, you know, go into my flow state, come back, and it's so powerful for me personally to have this, the drum set in the office to, just refresh my mind. Yeah. So that's maybe a kind of a fun fact about me. Yeah.
That is actually pretty cool. And yeah, music plays an important role. Actually, if you look at the guests on Supply Chain Pioneer, I feel that 50% of people that joined the podcast were musicians. And I do feel it's a very common theme within supply chain professionals that creativity in one way, shape, or form is a very important part of relieving stress, because in the end it can be a very stressful job. No matter if you are founding a company or you just work operationally, there's a lot of different aspects to that.
And I'm not sure if I may share, but you shared with me in our conversations in the past that, I mean, I know you play an instrument as well, and yet you're always bringing people together in the companies you work with to make music together, right? So turn out very powerful for you as well.
The reason I started making the videos was because we couldn't play in bands anymore and I needed a creative outlet. So
okay. See? Nice. Okay,
that's how this podcast essentially came into place. Yeah, it is what it is.
Love it,
Lucas. We are at the end of this journey of this podcast. It was a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you.
So maybe at one point you come back and share how the future story has been. I would actually be quite curious about that. And
I'd love to.
For now, I just want to say to everybody who listened and watched, please go and hook up Lucas on LinkedIn. I think he has some great stuff to share as well. Sometimes he shares some videos as well. So that's really good. Hook up with him on LinkedIn. And otherwise, I just have to say bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Ulf.
This was Supply Chain Pioneers. Thanks for watching, listening, or however you are enjoying this podcast. You can find Supply Chain Pioneers on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all other major podcast players, as well as on YouTube at Ulf Talks Supply Chain. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, and comment. See you next time.